Hi everyone, and welcome to the Nordic Africa podcast, a series of conversations on contemporary Africa. Today we're going to talk about the Sahel in West Africa, where there has been an epidemic of coups spreading over the past couple of years. And the three Sahelian countries, Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger, are today de facto governed by military junta regimes, who show little or no interest to return to democratic rule. And on January 27th, these three junta-led states jointly announced their intention to withdraw from ECOWAS, the Economic Community of Western African States. And this decision came in response to ECOWAS having put pressure on them for a long time to restore democracy. And in this episode, we will explore the background of this rift within ECOWAS and what it means for West Africa in general and for the Sahel in particular. And I'm Henrik Alfsson. I'm a communications officer with the Nordic Africa Institute. And sitting next to me is my dear colleague, Heba Habib. Who is also a communications officer at the Nordic Africa Institute. Heba, will you introduce our guests?
Yes, I would be glad to. With us today is our very own senior researcher, Jesper Bjørnsen.
Hello.
And with us, our visiting scholar, Babatunde Fagaibo, who is a scholar of international law at the University of Pretoria and a visiting scholar here at NAI. Welcome, Babatunde.
Thank you. And thank you, Henrik. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming. Heba, are we going to fight about who's going to do the first question? Or
As usual, yes. But I'll do it this time. We'll begin with a little explainer of ECOWAS. So ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States, is the biggest of the regional economic communities of the African Union, the AU. It comprises 15 member states with a total of more than 420 million inhabitants. Its history stretches almost half a century back. When it was founded in 1975, it mainly dealt with issues of economic integration between the member states, as the name implies. But since then, its agenda has expanded to cover security cooperation, promotion of democracy, and other areas. So, what are the missions and mandates of ECOWAS today? Babatunde, maybe you can take that?
Yes. So, as you said, started as a trade or economic bloc, but of course, there's always a spillover effect, right? So, you cannot deal with trade and not dabble into issues of human rights, into issues of governance and democracy. And because of, you know, the conflict, the many conflicts in ECOWAS in the 1980s and, of course, the big civil wars in the 1990s, it, you know, had to set up some sort of a regional standby force, ECOMOG, that was able to stop the wars in Liberia and Sierra Leone. So peace and security also became one of its core components. In fact, it has one of the most relatively developed security standby force on the continent for the kind of works it's done. And it's also been able to put out fires, right, in terms of, you know, dealing with early warning systems, mediation, you know, civil society. It has a robust civil society. And it has also created many institutions. The ECOWAS Court is always referenced as one of the strongest of the sub-regional courts on the continent. So it has all of those things. And of course, it's a free movement protocol is referenced, widely referenced as well, as one of the best on the continent.
Okay, yes, but that's nothing to add. So we'll move on to the second question. So what happens now if ECOWAS would transition into a split where the coastal states would remain within ECOWAS and the inner Sahelian states would break out? What implications would that hold for this organization as a promoter of good governance and democracy? And what challenges might arise in ensuring a consistent enforcement of regional norms and principles? Maybe Jesper, you want to go first out on that?
Yeah, well, I can start, and I'm sure Babatunde can add some depth to the question as well. I think the first thing to acknowledge here is that the reason why we're having this conversation is because of the threat by the three Sahelian states, Burkina Faso, Mali, and Niger, of leaving ECOWAS, right? And they are the central Sahelian state, so it would mean that in practice, ECOWAS would become almost this sort of coastal belt of West African states. First of all, I think we might come back to that later, but I think it's important to acknowledge that this is sort of the early stages of a political negotiation between the three Sahelian states and ECOWAS. So it's by no way given that there will be this kind of a withdrawal. Let's see what happens, you know. But if we want to talk about sort of what is at stake in this threat of a withdrawal, I think on the one hand,
The fact that these three states have even threatened to leave the organization just shows how weakened ECOWAS is. And it's there's always been ruptures within the organization, different member states wanting different things, which is normal in a regional community. You have it within the European Union as well, that some states pull in one direction politically, other states in another. So that in itself is not sort of an existential problem necessarily. But then, of course, the sort of re-emergence of military coups has put ECOWAS in a particularly difficult situation because an unconstitutional change of government is against its very founding principles, right? So ECOWAS has to make a stance and has to react when an elected government is ousted by an unconstitutional force, whether that be military or not, right? So the military coups in West Africa have put ECOWAS under pressure. And the threat of withdrawal now is an extra threat to the organization. That said, the three countries threatening to leave the organization are not necessarily the sort of the foundational building blocks of ECOWAS. I mean, they are relatively poor countries. They're among the poorest in the community. And they don't have a lot of political leverage, especially now that they're under military rule. They were already, you know, under heavy sanctions by ECOWAS. So they're not exactly losing, like, the best pupils in the class, if you want. Mm-hmm. So it's not a threat to the existence of ECOWAS, but obviously if some states choose to leave, it could also set a precedence for other states wanting to challenge the setup of ECOWAS. But maybe, Babatunde, you can add to that.
Yes. Yes, of course. I agree with Jesper completely there, saying, you know, there's been this exaggerated view that this is actually, it spells the end, or the death knell, the final nail of the coffin for ECOWAS. These are some of the poorest states in the organization. I mean, Nigeria contributes about 75% to the budget of ECOWAS. So if Nigeria leaves, then we could say, of course, that's the end of ECOWAS, right? Or if Cote d'Ivoire leaves, or if Ghana leaves. But again, there's also the idea of, you know, the branding of ECOWAS. So let's see it from different perspectives. So the branding, the cohesion that ECOWAS shows to the rest, to say, look, this is a strong organization. We've been able to achieve so much in spite of all our problems. That has been ruptured, obviously, by the exit of these three. Then, of course, the security implications, of course, of leaving as well, the implications it will have on, you know, already struggling boundaries and borders, the jihad movement, you know, and all of those things. And of course, the implication also on the economic condition of the peoples. I mean, many reports have been released, or newspaper actually articles even showing how traders, how it has affected food prices between even Nigeria and Niger, right? We share a boundary. So all of these things shows that we, you know, it's actually not a good thing. But that does not necessarily mean that this is the end of ECOWAS.
Yeah. Maybe I can just expand on that a little bit, because it's one thing to ask sort of what is the, like, how does the problem look from the ECOWAS perspective? But if you look at the three Sahelian states threatening to leave, you know, an exit will have massive implication for their economies, because they will be exiting, for example, the protocols of free movement and the free movement of both goods and people, which mean that, you know, they will have to set up bilateral agreements with their neighboring countries, and it will take time to readjust border control, taxing, customs, all these things. So it will be very impractical for the three countries threatening to leave, and that will have severe implications on the populations. They're exiting this regional sort of collaboration, which is not just on security, but on a range of issues, right? So we can think about the threat of a withdrawal from the perspective of ECOWAS, but it's also important to think about the implications for the citizens of the three states threatening to leave, right? Because they will be exiting a regional collaboration along several different dimensions.
Is this why you would say that kind of ECOWAS is trying to placate, for example, Niger right now? They've sort of softened the blow of the economic sanctions that they were about to impose on them. Is it to prevent this, or what is the rationale behind it?
I think, yeah, so one has to look at it this way. Of course, ECOWAS also understands the security implications, right? The fact that if these three leave, you know, it would have significant ramifications on some of the anti-terrorist and, you know, the issues being suffered. ECOWAS also understands the fact that it does not have the capacity to enforce, you know, some of the, you know, some of the statements that it had previously made about invasion, about, you know, militarily stopping the coups and all of those things. And the reality is also the national politics, right? National politics in many of these countries, in Nigeria, for example, it's not popular. You know, the fact that these countries have been, were sanctioned. So in northern Nigeria, for example, there was a meeting between the governors of the state in northern Nigeria and the president, or statement by governors in the northern state saying, we can't afford to engage in, you know, military intervention and all of these things because we will bear the brunt, because we share about 1,600 kilometers of border with Niger. So all of these factors, and the fact that it goes back to what we said earlier about even the symbolic, and that this whole idea of, you know, we have, you know, relatively, we've done well relatively since 1975, you know, by you pulling out actually sends a very, you know, negative, wrong message to the rest about the things we are trying to build. So all of these factors actually put together. And, oh, let me add this as well, that, in fact, there's no consensus, even within ECOWAS, about, you know, about sanctioning these three, right? So if you add all of these factors, right, you'll see why it was, you know, politically necessary to bring them back. But before I, this last one, I keep saying last thing, that we must also look at it from the side of the trio, the military junta in Niger, Mali, and Burkina Faso. The fact that this is also some sort of political game for them. So what they want is this kind of attention to say, listen, we need legitimacy. They also need some sort of legitimacy for them to be accepted as the government, right? And this whole idea of leaving the organization also is a clear indication to say, if you're not going to give us the legitimacy, if you're going to act like this, then of course we have the popular support on our side within our countries. Then, of course, we will tell you we are leaving. So if you add all of these factors to it, you will see why it is politically expedient and politically rational to kind of, you know, calm the tensions down a bit and say, gentlemen, you know, let's talk.
Maybe I can put it a bit more sort of crudely. I think that I think
we so welcome crudeness,
right? Well, it's my brand.
Your old Danish hammer.
Exactly. Yeah. No, I was thinking that. I mean, even before the threat of withdrawal, ECOWAS was facing a situation where growing number of states were experiencing these military coups, and mm-hmm. of course, the remaining states under democratic rule, on paper at least, are not interested in that trend spreading, right? So they have an interest in sort of still trying to set the foot down and show that, you know, we need to restore order. Mm-hmm. And then I think on the backdrop of the threat of a military intervention in Niger as well, which was completely sort of unrealistic mm-hmm. from the get-go, right? And ECOWAS is now in damage control mode. I think they have to face up to the fact that they presented a threat of military intervention that they couldn't really follow through on. Mm-hmm. Their bluff was called, and now they need to sort of approach those three states and show that, okay, maybe we can talk this out and find some kind of solution. And obviously the softening of sanctions is the immediate tool to do that.
Well, you both mentioned that ECOWAS has kind of their bluff has been called, but if we look back on the case, similar but not identical event with the Gambia a few years ago, where ECOWAS actually did intervene successfully to suppress what was about to be an undemocratic change of government. In the toolbox of sanctions that did ECOWAS have then that they haven't been able to use now?
Yeah. I think we also have to understand the differences in the geopolitics, right? Senegal was a much stronger partner. ECOWAS was in a different state then, actually, than now. So ECOWAS was not dealing with three states all saying they are leaving. And the whole ECOWAS had, you know, some sort of capacity. Senegal was ready to actually intervene then, right? Senegal almost encircled Gambia, except for the Atlantic Ocean. They were ready to intervene. And Gambia is a small country. How many military officers do you have in the Gambia? right? A couple of thousands. And so you had a stronger neighbor, you had this strong will, you had, it was in a different situation. It had not been overwhelmed by this terrorist, jihadist movement at that point in time. So that's the main difference. And I remember people saying it back then when the Gambian situation occurred. Like, were Gambia to be a stronger, a much bigger, and a stronger ECOWAS member state, would ECOWAS have reacted the same way?
So. Yeah, I also think it's very much about the scale of military force in a way. And I mean, we were all holding our breaths a little bit, even when the ECOWAS troops arrived at the Gambian border to see what kind of intervention would this actually be. Mm-hmm. So if you had had sort of outright fighting in the streets of Banjul, even if it's a small confrontation in a small country, that could have had quite severe implications, because it's not really the face of ECOWAS anymore. It was different during the civil wars in Liberia and Sierra Leone, for example. And ECOMOG, as I understand it, also operated quite a lot in collaboration with the UN forces, for example, in sort of a peacekeeping mission. So, the political situation has changed a lot, and then it's definitely this question of scale. But I'm sure that, you know, the threat came from a place of thinking that, well, it worked in the Gambia, so why not play that card again? But of course, Niger, I mean, the armed forces in Niger have been trained systematically by mm-hmm. the US and by Europe for a decade because of the jihadist threat in the region. So it's a highly specialized and very resourceful army. And yeah, that's another issue facing ECOWAS now.
Very interesting. Speaking of jihadist violence, so there has been an increase of, as we've mentioned, in the Sahel of jihadist violence, and it's one of the main drivers of the current crisis. How far back in time does this stretch, and what ways has it contributed to the fragmentation of ECOWAS? Or has there really been a fragmentation of ECOWAS? Is it just a tension, a momentary tension, I suppose?
Yeah, I'm not... Maybe, Babatunde, you have a reflection on whether the security crisis in itself has created fragmentation within ECOWAS. I'm not entirely sure. You could imagine a scenario where a kind of an external threat to the security of member states could also bring the community together, right? Mm-hmm. And say that this is a time where ECOWAS needs to work together to face this threat. But what has happened for sure, I mean, you know, first of all, the UNHCR are calling the humanitarian crisis in the Sahel region one of the most overlooked in the world. We have more than 2 million displaced people in the region, most of them internally in their countries of origin. And we've seen the spread of a large number of different armed groups with some affiliation to either Al-Qaeda or Islamic State, and also working with funding from Algeria and other powerful states on the continent. And that is a security threat that has just been escalating. And of course, this was registered on the radar of the international community primarily after the failed insurrection in Mali in 2012, where you had domestic Tuareg groups trying to sort of challenge their marginalization within the Malian state. But then they gradually received support from these internationally funded groups who had a different agenda. And that allowed these international groups to really settle in Mali and build up not a mass recruitment, but a secure base from which to operate. And so it's at least a decade now of these groups operating from Mali and out in the region. And they've deployed different tactics over time, and it's a super complicated conflict scenario, if you will. So I think it's a really interesting question. I don't know, Babatunde, what you think. I mean, the way things have developed, elected governments in these three states, Mali, Burkina Faso, and Niger, the elected governments were put under immense pressure because they were not delivering on providing security in the face of these jihadist groups. So you could say that the security crisis has led to the military takeovers in a way. But I'm not sure whether that in itself has led to, I mean, how different are the voices within ECOWAS in terms of how to handle the security crisis? I'm not sure. My impression is that it's been seen very much as a national issue for a long time, that, well, this isn't Mali's problem. This is Burkina Faso's problem. It's not a regional problem, but maybe I'm not entirely sure.
No, I agree with you 100%, because even the response to terrorism and, you know, the jihadist movement within ECOWAS has actually often been handled via ad hoc security arrangements, right? Think of the multinational joint task force, because of course this also cuts across Central Africa, right? So between Nigeria and Chad, between Chad and Cameroon, Nigeria and Cameroon and the rest. So, and that was why you needed some sort of ad hoc arrangement, you know, the G5 Sahel and all of those things. So, and I agree by saying it's often been seen as maybe a national thing. And of course, ECOWAS has not really, so there's never been an ECOWAS force, so to speak, handling some of these things. So it's been handled. And that was the reason why, you know, one of the things Niger did, and the rest, actually Niger, Mali, I think, and Burkina Faso, was to kind of remove themselves from MGNTF and also the G5 to, you know, register their displeasure with their the suspension, not expulsion, suspension from ECOWAS. But I think it's also important for us to, because this also segues into a very fundamental question. When we look at security implications within ECOWAS, we also have to look at it holistically, right? And to see how many factors, democratic backsliding and all of those things, also contributed to this kind of the situation that we have, and the inconsistencies of the organization to also address this. So from Cote d'Ivoire to Benin Republic, you know, and even problems with democracy in Nigeria and, you know, and things like that. There's not been this consistent approach to handling the early warning crisis, early warning systems. And of course, that's why it's not surprising that there's a popular support within these countries for, of course, people supporting them also understand the fact that, you know, there are issues with security and all of those things. But the fact that the support also comes from the fact that there's been serious democratic backsliding, corruption, and all of those things, right? And they see ECOWAS. So the legitimacy deficiency of ECOWAS also comes from that, saying perhaps ECOWAS should have responded when, of course, elections were being rigged, when there was large-scale corruption, when people were changing constitutions and all of those things. Nothing happened. Now that we have military crisis, you are coming in, you know, and things like that. So I just think it's important for us to also situate it within that context.
I think maybe it's good to just remind people about the G5 Sahel, because so it's a regional security cooperation that was set up in response to the growing threat of jihadist violence in the Sahel region, right?
When was that?
I think it was set up in 2014. It's more or less dismantled again. Mm-hmm. So it failed. But it was set up sort of, which is ambitious, right, to set up a new collaboration in response to an ongoing crisis rather mm-hmm. than to rely on a framework that's already there. And it's been criticized for also being too heavily funded by Europe and sort of led by European interests, rather than being led by genuine regional interests. But it's important to remember now, because what really brought the three military regimes together was the security issue. So their first shared decision was to leave these security collaborations in the region, and to say that we can do better on our own in facing the threat of jihadist violence. And this then led to the withdrawal from, or the threat of withdrawal from ECOWAS. So it's an illustration of how central this security crisis in the region has been to the gradual isolation of these three states from regional collaboration. So I think that's good to keep in mind.
So you already touched upon one of the most important issues in this case. It's the sanction toolbox of ECOWAS, or the lack of sanctions in some cases. Could you develop a bit more on this? What tools does ECOWAS actually have in its toolbox of sanctions? And how effective are they? And what tools are they lacking?
Yeah, so, I mean, how effective? I mean, the fact that the three, especially Niger, left, is the organization also speaks to the effectiveness of the sanctions, the economic sanctions, right? The fact that the borders were closed, Niger was able to at least exert its pressure, you know, cutting off the electricity supply, you know, to Niger, freezing the assets and all of those things. So to some degree, to some extent, the economic sanctions worked. They worked, right? The politics of it is what we are dealing with now. to say, could it have been handled in a different way? Right. Of course, the idea of intervening, everybody, I mean, it's an open secret in ECOWAS that ECOWAS had no capacity to intervene in these three countries, militarily intervene, when even Nigeria itself is bogged down by huge, can't afford to allow to contribute soldiers and the rest to an ECOWAS, a so-called ECOWAS standby force. So those worked. The economic sanctions worked. The politics of it is the problem, right? Is to say to start asking ourselves that rather than dealing with the disease, shouldn't we be dealing with the symptoms, right? If we had paid serious attention to early warning crisis, we would not be where we are now, right? If ECOWAS, took serious attention or paid serious attention to rigging of elections, to fraudulent electoral processes, to presidents extending their terms without, so we think of the case in Senegal. We have not really mentioned Senegal here, but I think what the Senegalese case has also showed. Macky Sall had unilaterally postponed the elections. The presidential elections in Senegal, which was slated for February 25. And that in itself is a violation of ECOWAS norms. In fact, it is tantamount, it's the same thing as the military coups, actually, because it's an unconstitutional change of government. You are not allowed to do that 6 months before elections, right? And he did that literally 3 weeks before the election. So that, and the fact that ECOWAS sent a message when that was done, and the fact that the Constitutional Court in Senegal also ruled against it, and the fact that Macky Sall said, I will respect this, that is also some sort of, one positive thing in this milieu of negatives in ECOWAS.
Well, let me bring you back to the negative.
I thought you were the resident optimist.
Yeah, I was supposed to be the optimist here. But yeah, no, but I just think, on this question of sanctions, I think, so first of all, I'm in no way a specialist on this issue, but what I've seen from friends and colleagues in the Sahel region is the reaction that these broad-based economic sanctions, where you sort of close borders, but also halt trade and different tools to slow down the economies of the countries seen as transgressing the rules of ECOWAS, that the criticism is just from the people I know in the region that, this is hitting the population much harder than the military regimes. And it's a very sort of common, of course, criticism against broad-based sanctions, right, around the world, is that they don't really affect the elite, so the actors you want to influence, only indirectly. So the logic behind that kind of a sanction is you create dissatisfaction in the population that puts pressure on the political actors to then change their ways. So there's that kind of criticism. And it's true that it seems that Niger, for example, being one of the poorest countries, not just in the region, but in the world, has been much more vulnerable to economic sanctions than many other countries would be. It would have taken much longer for Senegal, for example, to feel the effects of economic sanctions, right? But in this particular case, it may have had a different kind of effectiveness for that reason. It also made me think about another negative aspect, which is that the political sanctions generally don't have a lot of traction, right? So you can expel a member state from ECOWAS when you have a military takeover, but usually the military juntas are not particularly interested in being part of that club anyway. So it's not a very effectful kind of sanction to say, oh, you can't vote in ECOWAS deliberations, for example. So yeah, the toolbox is there, but it's not particularly hard hitting necessarily, unless it's combined with other tools.
Sure, yeah.
Yes. Go ahead, yeah. Babatunde.
No, I just wanted to say that even the sanctions, the economic sanctions, the effect, it was also felt in Nigeria on the other side of the border, right? Mm-hmm. So some small traders, small scale traders, and also people who actually whose livelihood depend on just going across the boundaries also felt it. And part of the effect of it was also for them to say, look, maybe it's important for ECOWAS to actually to drop those sanctions, because it's not only affecting Nigerians, it's also affecting Nigerians, and I'm sure it also affected the prices of onions and food and all of those things across the region. But you touched on something, Jesper touched on something very important about the toolbox, right? Like what should be done in terms of the toolbox, sanction toolbox, is also to, you know, to see any transgression of democracy within ECOWAS as pure transgression. So there's no need for any scale, you know, to start, you know, creating typologies or types of violation of democracy, right? They say, oh yeah, but at least he or she was formally elected. So yeah, even if they're trying to tamper with the constitution, it's fine, as opposed to, you know, this military boys who are doing that. You see the same thing, right? Because by doing that, you also reinforce the legitimacy of that organization to show that the organization is very clear, consistent. People are very, very, I mean, part of what people are saying, civil society, saying in many of these countries, right, or even across ECOWAS, not only even in these three countries, is that talking about the inconsistencies of ECOWAS in the face of violation of regional norms, in the face of, you know, even responding, implementing regional norms. Mm. Of course, that also applies to the African Union.
Yeah, that's a really good point, actually, because you could think that even if the sanctions, both economic and political sanctions, are fairly weak in and of themselves, they would be much more effectful towards a regime who wants legitimacy, right? So ECOWAS could have used that toolbox much more efficiently towards sort of, for example, speaking out against rigged elections, mm-hmm. or constitutional amendments where the regime is trying to stay in power by changing the constitution. If ECOWAS had used its sanctions toolbox there in those cases, it would have posed a real political problem to a government claiming to be legitimately elected, right? So it's an irony that, you know, ECOWAS is stepping up and trying to use its sanction toolbox towards military regimes who don't really give a damn, you know, and they're just too slow to get into that game. But maybe that's a lesson for the future of the organization.
In what ways has the involvement of external actors like France, China, Russia, USA, and others affected regional stability in West Africa in general, and the Sahel in particular, particularly in light of perceived shortcomings and in the international interventions like MINUSMA and Operation Barkhane that you mentioned briefly, Jesper?
Yeah, I can start in the Sahel, and maybe Babatunde can lift the view a little bit to the ECOWAS as a whole. Yeah, so in terms of the security crisis in the Sahel, I mean, first of all, we can't really not address the elephant in the room that, you know, almost all of the both successful and attempted military coups in West Africa have been in former French colonies or in Francophone countries. I'm not saying that the French colonial history caused the military coups, but there's definitely something politically happening in terms of these Francophone states. And there's sort of a new, first of all, there's from the side of the population, there's a will to sort of reclaim independence from, especially from France, but from Europe once again. So this has been a kind of a pendulum over since independence, basically. You've had periods of time where people have been very conscious of the continued influence of Europe on local domestic affairs, and then periods of time where priorities have been different. But there's definitely something happening there. More specifically in what's going on in the Sahel, it's clear that the French military intervention first in Mali in 2012 really saved the Malian state from the Tuareg rebellion. It was quick, it was efficient, and it was relatively it didn't escalate violence, at least. What happened since then has been a complete disaster. France is being accused of having escalated violence in Mali in particular by choosing a hardline military approach with no room for negotiation. This was being criticized way before the military coup in Mali in 2020, right? So that's just a complete blunder. And the UN-led MINUSMA mission was not able to really challenge the French approach. They were dependent on France's knowledge of the region and contacts in the region. So MINUSMA were too reliant on France to really stake out a position of their own. So now, from the view of especially the three Sahelian states, the view is that, you know, the international forces have just made things worse. Mm. And what we need now is to get them out so that we can start over and build up our security ourselves on our own terms. So that has been a complete disaster, and it will take years, if not decades, for France especially, but for Europe as well, to renegotiate its relations with these states. So ECOWAS should definitely not back down on its democratic norms. Those can be promoted regardless of what tools you have to apply political pressure, whatever. It's still sort of a valid set of founding principles that the organization can base itself on, right? And it should be easy for other international organizations to back that intention, if you want to call it that. So I think that's the first point, is that there's still a room for democratic norms, and there's, you know, there's a strength in numbers in the sense that a regional community, you know, lifts that message stronger than an individual member state. Then, as we have said, I mean, in apart from the security aspect of ECOWAS, I mean, many of the other sort of founding principles of the organization are working fairly well. So the Protocol for Free Movement, for example, as Babatunde said in the beginning, has been working well. And there's a growing interest in continental integration and continental free movement, for example, represented through the Continental Free Trade Area Agreement, right? So ECOWAS has the experience to sort of implement these kinds of regional integration protocols. And that sort of mandate is still in demand, if you will. It won't go away. So there's room for ECOWAS to do other things than just address security issues. I think I'll leave that to Babatunde maybe to think more about, like, what are the prospects for ECOWAS acting as a regional security actor?
Yes, thank you. And I think the key word here is synergy, right? Because it's the UN, the AU, the ECOWAS. There has to be increased synergy, right? Synchronization of efforts, because in fact, in the context of the principle of subsidiarity, that is the organization closest to the action that has to as the first line of response, is ECOWAS, right? And the AU has been very clear about that, saying, look, we support ECOWAS's move, we support the decisions by ECOWAS in imposing sanctions, in kind of relieving sanctions, in dealing with these issues. So there has to be more synergy, right? And in fact, for external bodies like the UN or the European Union, there's also kind of the need to respect the peace and security architecture of the African Union, because eventually, I mean, the African Union is the primary regional organization in Africa, right? The idea is to harmonize all the structures, right? So even ECOWAS also draws from the African peace and security architecture. Yes, ECOWAS has its own architecture, but again, it should not conflict with, you know, with that of the. So there has to be strong support for the peace and security architecture and all of those. And as I said, the last part is for ECOWAS to also engage in serious introspection. It is very, very, very important. As the old English proverb says, charity begins at home. So, you know, sort yourself out first.
How lovely to go out with a proverb. A perfect ending. Thank you very much, Babatunde, Jesper, for sharing your expert knowledge and your analysis. Very interesting. So, and thank you to our listeners. And if you're interested in listening to other episodes of the Nordic Africa podcast, please visit our website, nai.se. Thank you very much.
Thank you.